Issues Etc. returned to the air after being canceled by the previous leadership of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod during Holy Week of 2008. For a special 10-year anniversary donation of $100 or more, we'll send you a CD of Issues Etc. listeners' top 12 hymns. You can make an anniversary gift online at issuesetc.org or by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. It's a very big subject for the 16th century reformers. We already started in our last conversation with Pastor Paul McCain a brief introduction to it. The Mass is what it is called at the time. Now, they're talking about something that they want to affirm and continue, and a lot of things that they want to reject and permanently discontinue. They're dealing with a doctrine that needs to be sorted in a very careful way, truth from error, and the traditions of men from the commandments and institutions of God Himself. That's what they're doing when they take up the issue of the Lord's Supper, but it's even bigger than actually the Lord's Supper. It has to do with Christian worship and the form of worship. We'll get into all of that as our conversation on the Lutheran Confessions continues on this Friday afternoon, July the 6th. Pastor Paul McCain joins us. He's publisher and executive director of editorial for Concordia Publishing House, based in St. Louis, and general editor of Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions. Paul, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd. Great to join you today.
Paul, last time we started talking about the Mass, and you spoke briefly about the term itself, but it does need some clarification because, of course, the Reformers are not dealing with the enormous amount of confusion that exists today about that proper term.
Right. And even if you read the Book of Concord, person, for instance, works through the reader's edition of the Book of Concord, and in this section, the very first thing Melanchthon asserts is, we don't abolish the Mass, but we keep it religiously and defend it. And then you turn over to Luther's small cult articles, and his first comment about the Mass is, the Mass and the papacy has to be the greatest, most horrible abomination since it directly and powerfully conflicts with the chief article. So if you read those two things, you might be confused, but you have to pay very close attention to Luther's choice of words. He says, the Mass in the papacy. In other words, the best way for us to distinguish between the word Mass in the sense of simply the service of Holy Communion and the Mass as it became misunderstood and abused by the Roman Church is always to refer to the Roman Catholic Mass, and that's what I try to do when I talk about it. But the Mass, the word itself, simply derives, it's kind of, the derivation is kind of bizarre. Everywhere you look to try to get a handle on it, it all traces itself back to the very closing words of the Mass, which is a dismissal. Ita Missa Est, which means basically, go home, it's over. It's almost like the end of the movie Ferris Bueller. Why are you still here? Go home. Go, the Mass is ended, is how it's more formally translated. And so, for reasons nobody can understand, that word Mass, derived from the Latin Missa, became a shorthand for this service of Holy Communion, which was observed, as the Lutherans say right here, as Melanchthon says, among us, reformed and errors removed very religiously. He's referring to simply the structure of the historic order of service in which Holy Communion is celebrated, observed, consecrated, distributed, and received. But then, on the other hand, you've got the Roman Catholic Mass, and Luther refers to it as an abomination because of how that Mass, as celebrated among the Romans, became a sacrifice being offered to God to atone for, to appease, to propitiate, to earn God's favor. I hope that's adequate, but so we're talking about two different things, and it's always important to get your terms straight and understand what we're talking about.
Now, one of the things that they really do want to make a point, and I think you began doing it last time we were talking, is against this notion of opus operatum, it's a Latin term that I would like you to explain a little bit, but they refer to it as that Pharisaic and pagan opinion, which they lament is all too common among the lay people at the time.
Yes, this was the theory that, I'm just going to put in a real simple term because I even refer to it. This is from paragraph 2. They clearly imagine that the mere work of hearing a mass said is a service that it benefits without being understood. That's a good way of understanding this catchphrase. It's a Latin phrase meaning from the work worked, ex opere operato, or ex opera operatum. They derive from the work of Christ, but then it gets twisted around, the sacraments do, to mean that simply by being there while these things are performed or done, the mere act of doing them earns God's grace and favor. We don't teach that about the Lord's Supper. We believe that it's, you know, must be received in faith, aware of what's happening. But at this time in the Roman Church, there had developed this theory that simply standing there in the presence of a mass being said by a priest in the language Latin, which very few understood at the time, itself was an act of grace. You didn't even have to receive the consecrated elements. In fact, of course, as we've spoken about before, they had cut off the distribution of the blood of Christ under the form of wine to the laity. So this little catchphrase, ex opere operato, was a nice way of understanding this whole false understanding of how the sacraments are received efficaciously for our good.
They also deal, at the very beginning of this article, with the term sacrifice, and they say of their opponents who had written this document called The Confutation, and this is paragraph 14, in The Confutation, they said many things about sacrifice, although we purposely avoided this term in our confession because of its ambiguity. What's the problem there?
Well, here again, you've got to deal with the terms. You've got to understand what you're talking about. There are two kinds of sacrifice talked about in the scriptures themselves. And I'm looking at paragraph 19, to be specific. One is an atoning sacrifice. That is a work that makes satisfaction for guilt and punishment. The other kind is a sacrifice of thanksgiving, which does not merit forgiveness or reconciliation. It's practiced by those who have been reconciled so that we may give thanks or return gratitude for the forgiveness of sins that has been received or for other benefits received. These are biblical terms. You know, we hear the scriptures describe all the sacrificial system instituted by God through Moses as signs pointing to the last and final sacrifice of Jesus Christ, all pointing forward to them. And I don't mean to skip ahead too far here, but it's very important, as Melanchthon so wisely does, to say, basically, we are going to appeal to and have in view during this whole discussion what the book of Hebrews says about sacrifice. The book of Hebrews in the New Testament is the most brilliant commentary on the book of Leviticus and, frankly, the entire sacrificial system. The other kind of sacrifice is in the service of evening prayer, and the lifting up of my hands as the evening sacrifice. In other words, that's a sacrifice of praise to God.
Okay, so let's back up on both those terms, the Mass and sacrifice. You have clearly stated there is a right way to understand both of these terms. So why do you say it's still not time for Lutherans to be using those terms again? Why is it that we probably are wise to avoid both the term the Mass, although I think in certain contexts it can be used, and sacrifice when it comes to the divine service?
Well, I do have friends and colleagues who wish we could reintroduce the historic term, the Mass, but frankly, I always urge them, listen, guys, step back for a moment, take into context the entire history of the term at the time of the Reformation, understand how, as you and I have talked before, Todd, the Reformation took place in the confessional booth, which itself was a precursor to being eligible to receive the Lord's Supper in the Roman Catholic Mass. The Roman Catholic Mass was probably the most visible touch point of the Reformation because nowhere else was it so visibly obvious how wrong things had gone in the church, because the words of institution were efficacious, of course. We believe in the Roman Catholic Church. They have the real body and blood of Christ under the bread and wine of the sacrament. But they had completely twisted the Mass around. Instead of being a gift from God to us, it became a sacrifice that we offer back to God to recreate, reenact, or as the Roman Catholic Church likes to talk today, if you look at the modern, the most recent edition of the authoritative catechism of the Catholic Church, they like this language of representation. The Lord's sacrifice becomes present among us again through the Lord's Supper. And in a way, we could explain that correctly, but they still look at it as a propitiation for our sins that we are offering to God. And similarly, with the concept of sacrifice, honestly, we do have to explain that to our people because we do read throughout the Psalms. You know, and again, I go back to the just little phrase, lifting up of my hands is the evening sacrifice. What in the world does that mean? I will offer to you a sacrifice of thanksgiving. So we do have to talk a little bit and explain it, but we need to be very cautious because the best way to talk about sacrifice is to keep referring to the book of Hebrews. It clearly explains how Jesus is the last and final sacrifice, once and final, offered for all, never to be repeated.
So why do you say that, and you were simply repeating what we heard the Reformers say last time we talked, which is we retain the Mass and we even observe it more religiously than do our opponents. How can they make that claim?
Well, I don't mean to be self-serving here, but if people have a copy of the Reader's Edition of the Book of Concord, at this very point in the Apology, we inserted an editor's note, a little excursus, showing the reformation of the medieval Roman Mass and how Luther reformed it to keep basically most of the major elements, but to remove the offending part of the Roman Catholic Mass, which was called the Canon of the Mass, in which they have numerous prayers referencing the Mass as a sacrifice for the living and the dead, a commemoration of angels and saints. There was all kinds of physical motions and gesturing, the sign of the cross, and buried in all that were the words of institution. I mean, literally buried in all that. They would say a long, what they call Eucharistic prayer, and in the process of this complicated prayer referencing all this notion of propitiation towards God, the words of institution would appear. Luther basically kept as much as he could, and when it came time for communion, the words, "The Lord be with you and also with you," then the words of institution, preferably sung, because that was a more effective way of making sure everybody in the congregation could hear it, then the Sanctus, "Holy, holy, holy, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord," and there was absolutely no talk, and has been no talk, in the Lutheran, if you want to call it the Lutheran Mass or the Lutheran Divine Service, of sacrifice as propitiation to God. That was completely removed. The Canon of the Mass was the real culprit in all this.
So what's happening here in the, let's call it the Reformation of the actual, can we call it the Canon of the Mass, or should we just call it the Divine Service here at this point?
Yeah, well, that's another interesting conversation, and that comment comes up here in the Book of Concord. How do we refer to the Lutheran service? In Germany, while the Mass would appear in various church orders as a nomenclature, what became a much more common nomenclature, in fact, hearkening back to pre-Reformation times, is the German word, Gottesdienst, all one word, and Germans love to string nouns together, and that means God's service. Now, among us, there has been the trend to really emphasize that what this really means is God's service to us rather than our service to God. That is absolutely true. Okay, I'm not denying that, but we need to be a little careful not to get too carried away with that, because it's demonstrably the case that the Lutherans also intended the word to have a double entendre. God's service to us through his word, through the sacraments, which are signs of grace towards us as we read in this article, and then our service back to God. An easiest way to understand this is simply how Luther speaks, again, the simple language of the catechism, all for which it is our duty to thank and praise, serve, and obey. Okay? It's our response to the great gifts we receive in the Lord's Supper, in the service of Holy Communion. Yes, it's God serving us, and then that brings forth from us the fruit of thanks and praise, service and obedience. But the phrase divine service is probably the better one for us to use because it carries such historical freight among us, and it's so easy to use as to properly explain all this.
Pastor Paul McCain is our guest. It's our series on the Lutheran Confessions, part 15 on the Apology of the Augsburg Confession, dealing with the big subject of the Mass. He is publisher and executive director of editorial for Concordia Publishing House based in St. Louis and general editor of Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions. God's Word is filled with paradoxes. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July provides lenses to evaluate and bring clarity to these paradoxes. It's titled, Faith That Sees Through the Culture. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Faith That Sees Through the Culture, 1-800-325-3040.
Thanks to generous supporters, tuition for all incoming residential pastoral ministry and deaconess students at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, will be paid in full. Hi, this is Dr. Lawrence Rast, president of Concordia Theological Seminary. Learn more about studying for the vocations of pastor or deaconess in the 2018-19 academic year at ctsfw.edu.
Often imitated, never equaled. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century.
O come, O come, Emmanuel.
The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the Church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the Mass in our series on the Lutheran Confessions, walking through the Apology of the Augsburg Confession with Pastor Paul McCain of Concordia Publishing House. So how big of a deal, just since we're on the subject, how big of a deal is it at the time that Luther undertakes to reform the order of service that was universally in place in medieval Roman Catholicism?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was just thinking of this very thing. First of all, he came along and he completely upset the apple cart when it came to the Church's greatest stewardship campaign in history, the sale of indulgences. But even before indulgences were sold, for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, the Mass had become a source of incredible income for the Church. The very canon of the Mass, the part that Luther removed and heavily modified to take out any of the works righteousness, or, you know, we do this, God does that, ex opere operato, because we're doing the work, God's going to do his work for us. He got the Mass of that horrible language and horrible theology, and thus completely removed the possibility that Masses could be bought and paid for to be said privately by priests, as they were across any church of any size had multiple altars in the cities. They had multiple priests standing there literally day and night, particularly in the endowed monasteries called chapters. Wealthy people would endow entire monasteries to do nothing but babble away the Mass in private, in Latin, without anybody there, thinking that these works were earning God's grace for the people who sponsored the Mass. Now, Todd, you can imagine, you know, it's hard for us to put ourselves back in at that time, but these people sincerely believed this is what the Mass was doing for them, and you can only imagine how attractive it was to be able to pay for all that, and the enormous wealth that was flowing into the church as a result of this horrible theology. So yeah, first of all, he attacks indulgences, then he goes after the Mass. I mean, so Luther was shaking the church's entire existence and financial foundation to its very core for the sake of the gospel, not just to be a rebel or, you know, to throw stones at the Roman church, but to reform and bring the gospel back out to light and to restore the Lord's Supper to what it was when it was instituted by Jesus Christ and what it needs to be for the good of the church and the people of the church.
Now, in the midst of their conversation on the issue of the sacrifice, the Reformers say some things that I believe in our 21st century and 20th century context have been pulled out of context by Lutherans who want to fall off on the other side of the horse.
Yeah.
They really believe Luther didn't go far enough. They really believe that, even though they won't admit to it often, they'll go on and on about how they love the liturgy, but they refuse to practice it. They refuse to follow the form that was adopted by the Reformers. And one of the places that they cite is paragraph 27. In short, the worship of the New Testament church is spiritual. It is the righteousness of faith in the heart and the fruit of faith. And they say that's all it is. And from that point on, you cannot say any more about how Christians ought to worship in any form or another.
Right. And so often what we get is, well, we can be united in our confession, but we don't have to worry about being united in our practice. In other words, I can go to Congregation A in a given city. For let's just say St. Louis. I can go to St. Paul de Pere that uses the liturgies in the hymnal. I can go down the street somewhere and find a congregation where, you know, I won't name the church, but my son actually went to church there one Sunday and came home and said, "Dad, you won't believe what the pastor said. He said, do you remember back in the old days we used to say, 'I, a poor, miserable sinner'? That was terrible." I mean, now that's nuts. That's not unity in what we believe, teach, confess, and as Dr. Alberi liked to add to that little slogan from the formula, and practice. And people have this misunderstanding. And by the way, I think this is one of the first time. Well, I think the word adiaphora comes up for the first time here in the Apology. And that simply refers to things that are neither commanded nor forbidden by God. But note, we can't take that definition and add to it. We can't say things neither commanded nor forbidden, therefore irrelevant. Nobody at the time of the Book of Concord or into the Age of Orthodoxy ever understood. They couldn't conceive of a time when the Lutheran Church would see such huge disparities in practice, liturgical practice between congregations. The assumption, first of all, there was no such notion as congregations being so independently, so, you know, free to do whatever they want, that within the same church body or district, or call it what you want, the congregations would all be doing their own thing. Why? For the sake of order, for the sake of teaching Christ clearly, for the sake of peace, for the sake of just being able to confess the same thing by doing the same thing in the same way as much as possible. And, well, I could go on and on about this, but I hope that suffices.
They say at one point, this is paragraph 41, "Now, good people, it can be easily determined that the complaint against us, that we abolished the daily sacrifice, is entirely false." What are they saying there? Because that could easily be misunderstood today as well.
Well, yeah, you picked up on a very fascinating aside here. The Lutheran Church is not opposed to having a communion service every day, for that matter, as long as there are those who want to have it. For that matter, if you understand the term sacrifice here to be an offering of praise and thanksgiving, the Lutheran Church practice in any sizable parish the practice of daily services of prayer. So either they were offering the Lord's Supper very often, or they were referring to, again, sacrifice in the sense of our thanksgiving to God.
In a lot of ways, they are attempting to wrestle these terms back from medieval Roman Catholicism.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So that's the point. You've got to you've got to get your definitions clear. Make sure you are articulating exactly what you mean by the terms. And one of my beloved professors, Kurt Marquardt, was just full of little quips that he had picked up along the way. And I love this one. I found this to be so true in my experience as well. He loved to say, "You can say just about anything you want to say as long as you define it correctly." That's a brilliant insight, and there's no better example of that than how the Lutherans here in this article. There's a good way to say and use the word Mass. There's a bad way. Sacrifice can be properly understood and explained, but it can also become a horrible false doctrine if you get it wrong. You know, for that matter, law, gospel, all the terms that we find, to a certain extent, you can almost say anything you want, but you must explain it properly. But I do not advocate, I'm not one of these advocating that we try to reintroduce the term Mass to refer to the divine service.
Pastor Paul McCain is our guest on this Friday, July the 6th. We are in our series on the Lutheran Confessions, part 15, on the Apology of the Augsburg Confession, discussing the Mass and the term sacrifice. He's general editor of Concordia of the Lutheran Confessions. When we come back, he has mentioned several times the book of Hebrews. The Reformers actually say it's our main proof text. We'll see what they mean by that after this. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Grace Lutheran, Henderson, Nevada. Faith Lutheran, Orange City, Iowa. Bethany Lutheran, Fairview Heights, Illinois. Bethlehem Lutheran, North Zulch, Texas. Risen Christ Lutheran, Arvada, Colorado. Trinity Lutheran and Grace Lutheran, Wichita, Kansas. Emmanuel Lutheran, Perryville, Missouri. Risen Savior Lutheran, Basor, Kansas. St. John Lutheran, Champaign, Illinois. Trinity Lutheran, Auburn, Nebraska. Holy Trinity Lutheran, Columbia, South Carolina, Grace Lutheran, Elgin, Texas, Gethsemane Lutheran, Marion, Ohio, and St. John Lutheran, Springfield, Pennsylvania. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation becomes a congregational sponsor, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth, Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
When pastors talk about us, they call us ad crucem. When laity mention us, they speak of ad crucem. When non-Lutherans address us, they say ADC Rucam. But no matter how you say it, ad crucem is the place to go for greeting cards, artwork, jewelry, ornaments, housewares, church certificates, church banners, and all your gift-buying needs. Visit adcrucem.com, confessing the faith through art and word. ADC, RUCEM.com.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR17. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, a classical Christian education that works.
I've written a column in the latest Issues Etc. journal titled Confessions of a Well-Intentioned Preacher. It details how I mistakenly ignored or explained away entire parts of Scripture in order to protect my hearers from legalism. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Lyman Stone writes about the certainty he found in the presence of Christ in his word and sacraments. The free online Issues Etc. journal. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the Mass in our series on the Lutheran Confessions, dealing with the Apology, the Augsburg Confession. Pastor Paul McCain is our guest publisher and executive director of editorial for Concordia Publishing House based in St. Louis. Paul, what can you tell us about the Issues, Etc. book of the month for July, Faith That Sees Through the Culture by Dr. Alfonso Espinosa?
Well, it's interesting, Todd. It's perfect you ask me, because he's trying to make the point in this book that when we talk about culture, we might be tempted as Christians simply to throw the baby out with the bathwater, just like this article says, the Mass can be religiously observed properly among us. So what Espinosa is trying to do here is to help Christians see their way through, into, and then through the culture, and how to, you know, be in the world and not of it. And he latches on to dualities about the Christian faith, law and gospel, Jesus is divine and human, and how this all appears as we live our life in this culture, which can be good, can be bad, but culture is all persuasive, as he says, quote, along the way, it is for the Christian to know how to live in it, and that's what this book's going to help people do.
Find out more about Faith That Sees Through the Culture by Alfonso Espinosa, our Issues, Etc., book of the month for July. Call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours and order at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. It's on every page of the website. Let's talk again about the book of Hebrews. You mentioned early on in our conversation that it is really the go-to text for the Reformers on the issue of the Mass and the sacrifice. But they start by saying that their opponents quote from the Epistle to the Hebrews this particular verse, and I'm looking at paragraph 52. For every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. How is it that the Roman Catholics used that particular verse to make their point, and what was the Reformers' response?
Yeah, this is just, honestly, this is one of the more brilliant discussions Melanchthon has in the Apology itself. And first of all, it's exasperatingly stupid what they do with this passage. It's an ex post facto use of the scripture. You know, you run and try to grab something that'll sustain your position. And as Melanchthon says, based on that verse from Hebrews 5:1, they conclude that since there are high priests and priests in the New Testament, that means there's also a sacrifice for sins. And this passage particularly impresses the unlearned, especially when the showiness of the priesthood and the sacrifices of the Old Testament are spread before the eyes. So what happened is, well, the priests in the Old Testament wear all kinds of fancy clothing and go through all kinds of fancy rituals, so hence we're going to wear every piece of fancy clothing we can find and go through all kinds of rituals. As he says, this resemblance deceives the ignorant so that they decide that a ceremonial sacrifice should also exist among us in the same way, which should be applied for the sins of others, like in the Old Testament. There's the real problem. Again, misunderstanding the word sacrifice and what the purpose or the service of the Mass and the rest of the polity of the Pope is nothing more than false zeal for the misunderstood Levitical order. In other words, you cannot simply port over from the Old Testament the Levitical priesthood into the New Testament. And then they go on in paragraph 53 saying, the main proofs for our belief are in the Epistle to the Hebrews.
So what do they do with that? I mean, if you read the book of Hebrews, honestly, the whole point is there no longer needs to be made a sacrifice for sins. Christ is now our perpetual intercessor before the Father on the basis of his one last sacrifice.
Well, yeah, it boggles the mind. And in paragraph 54, Melanchthon even says, the Levitical sacrifices for sins did not merit forgiveness of sins before Christ. They were only an image of Christ's sacrifice, which was to be the one atoning sacrifice, as we've said before. The Epistle of Hebrews speaks about how the ancient priesthood and the ancient sacrifices were set up not to merit the forgiveness of sins or the reconciliation between God and man, but only to illustrate the future sacrifice of Christ alone. In the Old Testament, Here's an incredibly important assertion. In the Old Testament, saints had to be justified by faith, which receives the promise of the forgiveness of sins granted for Christ's sake, just as saints are also justified in the New Testament.
Okay, so I want to, again, they have to correct things on both sides. I want you to explain this phrase, and that is in paragraph 58. If anyone argues that in the New Testament a priest is needed to make offering for sins, this can only be said of Christ. Are they conceding that somehow Christ, that it is finished, isn't finished?
Oh, no, 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 no. Just the opposite. They're saying the basis on which the Lord's Supper is observed to this very day is entirely on the basis that the sacrifice of Christ on the cross is last and final, and now the Lord's Supper is, I almost use the word merely, that would be misleading. The Lord's Supper is the means by which that the benefits, the blessings, the forgiveness won at that, through that one time, once for all sacrifice, to which all previous sacrifices in the Old Testament system pointed, and in which all those sacrifices were finally fulfilled. Everything flows from that one sacrifice of Christ. It's not repeated, but the benefits of it, the blessings of it, are distributed by the power of God's word. This is my body, this is my blood, given and shed for you. And that's what they mean when they say, if we were to look for any other satisfaction, paragraph 58, that applies to the sins of others and so to reconcile God, this would be nothing more than to make other mediators in addition to Christ. And then he goes on to explain, the priesthood of the New Testament is the Spirit's ministry, as St. Paul teaches, 2 Corinthians 3:6. St. Paul there asserts, who has made us sufficient to be ministers of a new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. And it's very interesting here, the vocabulary, which is one reason why, even though the Scandinavian Lutherans retain the word priest for our ministers, the New Testament language of minister is always the word basically slave or servant. You do not have the same use of the concept of priesthood. They are servants of a new covenant.
Can we at least clarify here, they don't deal with it explicitly, but we do talk about a spiritual priesthood. And we actually talk about it in a very, very apostolic and New Testament sense. Can you speak about the priesthood of all the believers, or I think Luther probably would have preferred priesthood of all the baptized?
Well, this is an interesting concept, too. Even in the Old Testament, the entire people of God are referred to as a royal priesthood, a holy nation, and the New Testament fulfills all of that. Basically, our ministers, or as we in the Lutheran Church like prefer to refer to, in our Missouri Synod and also in many places in Germany, it became very common to refer to our pastors. Just as an aside, the image or the metaphor or the analogy of the ministry in the New Testament most predominant is that of shepherding or pastoring, you know, based on Christ is the good shepherd, my sheep hear my voice, and his under-shepherds, the pastors, the shepherds of the flock of Christ. So that nomenclature of pastor is very well rooted in New Testament images. As St. Peter says, you are a royal priesthood, a holy nation, and the duty of the royal priesthood, our duty, our vocation, which we are all given, is to bear witness to the great work of God in Jesus Christ, to be served by the Lord's ministers of the New Testament, who are merely the servants of Christ, who are distributing Christ's gifts to his royal priests. Priests are not ministers, ministers are not priests, but the priesthood of all believers simply refers to the fact that we all have direct access to Jesus Christ. We don't need a go-between. We don't require a priest to pray for us. We can pray directly. Our ministers are servants, which serve the local congregation by the call of Jesus Christ issued through the call of the congregation. And it's our joyful duty, again, to thank and praise, serve, and obey. That's the work of the royal priesthood.
They deal briefly with what the fathers thought about sacrifice. What do they find there?
Yeah, they appeal to the fact that in the very early church, and we see this in many of the early documents in the church, that there is no notion of a propitiatory sacrifice, but they do refer to the Lord's Supper as the Eucharist. The Eucharist derives from the Greek word for thanksgiving. Eucharistic sacrifice, paragraph 67 here, a Eucharistic sacrifice does not merit reconciliation, but is made by those who have already been reconciled. So the reply, I'm quoting here, the reply to the sayings of the fathers defends us well enough against the adversaries. And they just, again, say they're daydreaming about the merit of the outward act. And there they use the phrase opus operatum. This notion cannot be found in the early church fathers.
We're talking about the Mass in our series on the Lutheran Confessions, walking through the Apology of the Augsburg Confession with Pastor Paul McCain. He is general editor of Concordia of the Lutheran Confessions. When we come back, the terms sacrament and sacrifice, and then we'll talk about the practice of Masses for the dead.
Whether you're a man yourself or a woman who cares about the men in your life, you won't want to miss the June issue of The Lutheran Witness. Join John Kleinig, Hans Feeney, Jeffrey Hemmer, Broer Erickson, and others in this power-packed issue on men at church as they explore toxic masculinity, godly fatherhood, the religious gender gap, and more. Subscribe today at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Imagine this. What if you planned your vacation? You picked the location based upon where you knew there was a good Lutheran church. Well, we're here to let you know that if you're planning a Southern Oregon vacation, whether you visit Crater Lake, raft the Rogue, fish for salmon, or head down to the Redwoods, there's still a place for you to receive forgiveness. Faith Lutheran Church in Rogue River, Oregon. What's a vacation without the gospel? Faith Lutheran Church, Sundays at 10 a.m. Visit faithrogueriver.org.
The cross is always relevant. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod celebrates and affirms life from the time of conception until natural death, and every time in between. For this reason, LCMS Life Ministry is a program singularly devoted to upholding the sanctity of human life, both in our church body and the culture at large. Life Ministry provides educational materials, hosts conferences, and works closely with allies such as Lutherans for Life. For more information, visit lcms.org/life and follow LCMS Life Ministry on Facebook.
Do you long for a church where the gospel of the sinner's free justification is front and center, and yet where a robust sacramental life is confessed and lived? Do you long for a church that rejoices in the sacred scriptures as the sole basis for the church's teaching and proclamation, yet values and listens to the witness of the ancient fathers and councils? Welcome to the Lutheran Church. We are what you've been looking for. Find a Christ-centered, cross-focused church near you on the Find the Church page at issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's our series on the Lutheran Confessions. We're talking about the Mass with Pastor Paul McCain of Concordia Publishing House. So they also want to have a few words about, well, sacrament and sacrifice are the two words that they want to deal with. What occasions this distinction for them?
Well, I think this section, paragraph 68 and following, it contains some of the most short, beautiful explanations of the purpose of the Lord's Supper. It's kind of buried in this whole article, but it's wonderful. They have to do this because, as they put it, some clever men imagined the Lord's Supper was set up for two reasons. First, that it might be a mark and reference of profession, just as the particular shape of a hood is a sign of a particular monastic profession. Second, they think that such a mark was especially pleasing to Christ, namely a feast to illustrate mutual union and friendship among Christians, because banquets are signs of friendship. But this is a secular view. It neglects the chief use of the things delivered by God. So they're not saying those two aspects aren't true, but that's not the chief use. That's not the chief use. The sacraments, paragraph 69, and here comes these wonderful words. The sacraments are signs of God's will toward us, not merely signs of people among one another. The ecumenical movement today, the liberals, love to gas on about, oh, when we have the Lord's Supper, we come together. They might as well just have snacks, you know, milk and cookies together, because they've tossed out the Orthodox belief of what the Lord's Supper is. Those who define sacraments in the New Testament as signs of grace are correct. There are two things in a sacrament, a sign and the word. In the New Testament, the word is the promise of grace added. The promise of the New Testament is the promise of the forgiveness of sins. This is my body, which is given for you. This cup is my blood of the New Testament shed for you. So the word offers the forgiveness of sins.
All right. What about masses for the dead? Oh, what in the world was that about? I think you've explained it briefly before, but please do so. And how do the reformers deal with that? This is probably one of the more bizarre forms of the abuse that had crept into the mass.
Yeah, and historically, one can, I think, with pretty good foundation, argue that these masses for the dead were based, again, on practices derived from the ancient Roman religions, where it was common annually to go to a grave of a loved one and basically literally have a feast at the gravesite. Deriving from that practice from Roman paganism, there derived a lot of ideas that we can use the Lord's Supper, and somehow, again, if you consider the Mass as merely by the outward work applying the forgiveness of sins that you could buy, this is paragraph 78, you can apply it to others, this whole Mass would merit the forgiveness of sins for them. And then they got into this whole notion about liturgia, from whence we derive the word liturgy, and it's an ancient Greek term used, you know, well before the church was on the scene, of a public tax to pay for public observances. And so they have to go on and talk about what the liturgy does mean and doesn't mean.
One of the things they say about this, the practice of the Mass for the dead, and this is in paragraph 89, they say this violates the second commandment by abusing God's name.
Oh, of course. This is ridiculous. You cannot pay for the forgiveness of sins for others by asking a priest to offer, here in paragraph 88 they refer to, make us, this is from the canon of the Mass, or these Masses, make us worthy to bring to you prayers and requests and bloodless sacrifices on behalf of all people. Now, part of that's not wrong. We would want God to make us worthy to offer prayers, okay, or sacrifices of thanksgiving. But never in such a way that we are considering the Mass to be something we can say we're offering for the dead. And if you look at paragraph 89 again, Todd, they put their finger on it. They receive unlimited revenue from this.
They also say in paragraph 91, the practice pollutes the gospel and corrupts the use of the sacraments. How is it, I mean, someone might argue, no, this is even more gospel. This is so much gospel that it overflows to the dead as well. Why do they say it pollutes the gospel?
Well, because if you think you are led to believe that the very act of having a priest say a Mass for you or your loved ones or for the dead is meriting God's favor, suddenly the focus is taken off of the once, forever, and for all sacrifice of Jesus Christ, the benefits of which are being received as you receive the Lord's Supper. I mean, from this whole system developed this idea that there could be private masses, which would be paid for, sponsored by, endowed by sources of revenue from the rich, from the wealthy. People could chip in to basically spread the cost of a Mass being said. So they say, let us return to the matter. The Mass is not a satisfaction, either for punishment or for guilt, without faith. Therefore, applying it to the dead is useless.
Again, they seem to be kind of cutting straight through all of the pretext and the pretense of the system that had been set up to make, well, a lot of money for the church. A lot of money, not just for the hierarchy of the church, as in the case of the indulgences, but here we're talking about priests who are being paid to say masses for dead people, preying upon the fears, the anxieties of the living.
Well, if you go into many of the great cathedrals in Europe, while they did cut down on the number of altars in them, if you go to, you know, in the modern era in the Western world, if you go to places where the Roman Catholic Church is still, in many ways, not merely post-Vatican II, but pre-Vatican I, basically Council of Trent, you will go into these cathedrals like I did in Guatemala City. We went in there on a Sunday morning just to see what was going on. It was shocking. I mean, intellectually, I knew this was going on, but the LCMS missionary said, Paul, you're going to see pre-Tridentine Catholicism as it was in Luther's day. And I was like, yeah, right. He was absolutely right. We walked into this cathedral. There was a main mass going on with people milling about, literally milling about, walking in and out. The priest was babbling on about something, but then at every single altar on both sides of the church, there were priests standing there saying masses quietly, privately. There were some people. It was unbelievable. And this just completely took the focus off of the once-for-all sacrifice of Jesus Christ, and everything condemned in this article was going on in that cathedral.
There is a part here where they're dealing with masses for the dead that might cause a bit of confusion and maybe even raise some red flags for Lutherans reading it today. And this is in paragraph 94. They say, regarding the adversary's quoting of the fathers about the offering for the dead, we know that the ancients speak of prayer for the dead, which we do not ban. And then they go on to say what we disapprove is applying the Lord's Supper to the dead through ex opera operato. How are we to understand this? We do not ban prayer for the dead.
Well, I think, first of all, again, we have to understand the nature of the apology, as the same with the Augsburg Confession, of trying to be as conciliatory as possible. So when it refers to prayers for the dead, which we do not ban, this in no way would justify the kind of prayers for the dead and the kind of praying for the dead that went on at the time in the Roman Catholic Church. And, of course, the chief prayer for the dead was offering masses for them. Now, again, I'm going to have to cite Kurt Marquardt. He had a very nice way of dealing with this. He said, if you wish once or twice after a loved one is dead to basically say something in effect, thank you, O Lord, for receiving them into your gracious favor in eternal life, something like that, that's fine. But then let it go. You know, you don't keep this up. You don't make this a big part of the liturgy. And notice they say praying for the dead, not as if you're praying, oh, dear Lord, please save them, even though they were a bunch of filthy pagans. We don't do that. And notice it doesn't say praying to the dead, which was the chief error. Our biggest beef would be praying to the dead saints. So it's an aside, and I have some good friends that will disagree with me. It's an aside. It's not a dogmatic assertion. It's not prescriptive of what we must do today, but it's, I don't know, maybe that's enough said.
Finally, with only about a minute here, you also want to point out this is not the only place in the Lutheran Confessions
right. Where
the Reformers deal with the error of the Mass. It's really kind of all over the Book of Concord, isn't it?
Yes, it is, because it was such, and as it is today, the Mass is everything in the Roman Catholic Church, and that's both good and bad. I wish the Lutheran Church hadn't allowed itself to be influenced by our Protestant culture to the point that sometimes we tend to relegate the Lord's Supper to just, you know, almost an occasional service. But it's so important that this be kept clear, and that's why it's brought up so many times, because it was the chief, most visible activity of the Church, the main service of worship, the main public service, the main gathering, where there would be preaching, and there would be the Lord's Supper, distribution of the Lord's Supper. And in the Roman Catholic Church, preaching had declined, and the Mass became a way for people to earn salvation from God instead of to receive it as a gift through the means of the Lord's Supper.
Pastor Paul McCain is publisher and executive director of editorial for Concordia Publishing House based in St. Louis. He is general editor of Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions. Next time he'll join us to talk about the Apology of the Augsburg Confession on Monastic Vows. Paul, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Todd. God bless.
We've produced a CD of Issues Etc. listeners' top 12 hymns. It contains God's Own Child, I Gladly Say It, Lord, Thee I Love With All My Heart, We Praise You and Acknowledge You, Thy Strong Word, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, and more. We'll send you this CD for a special 10th anniversary donation of $100 to Issues Etc. You can contribute by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Be sure to write hymns CD in the memo line of your check. You can also make a financial gift online at issuesetc.org. Up next, Dr. Mike Middendorf, author of the Concordia Commentary on Romans, teaching on Romans 13, Christians and Governing Authorities. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Have you ever wanted to better understand philosophy and its impact on your family, your church, or your world, but didn't know where to begin? Concordia University, Wisconsin has an innovative, free online course for you entitled Philosophy Kata Christan. These six engaging video sessions are taught by noted Lutheran philosopher, lecturer, author, and pastor, Dr. Gregory Scholes. Learn more by clicking the Kata Christan logo at issuesetc.org. issuesetc.org.
Hi, this is Pastor Clayton from Zion Lutheran Church of Muskuta, Illinois, a proud supporter of Issues Etc. Zion is a congregation firmly grounded in God's grace given in the Word and Sacraments, where we treasure the timeless beauty of the liturgy. Zion is also a vibrant, young, family-friendly congregation where you would be warmly welcomed. Zion is located at 101 South Railway Street in Muskuta, Illinois, and we would love to share God's gifts of grace with you. For more information, please visit our website at zionmuskuta.com.
South Africa,
China,
Germany,
Trinidad and Tobago.
Did you know that people listen to Issues Etc. around the world? India,
Sweden,
Egypt, France,
Turkey,
Japan,
Australia,
Canada,
United Kingdom,
Hong Kong,
Austria,
Finland,
Malaysia,
Singapore,
Bulgaria,
Korea,
Brazil.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Help us proclaim Christ to the world.
The Philippines,
Mexico,
Spain,
New Zealand,
Kuwait,